answers to difficult, challenging problems, then you're going to be very disappointed, because I haven't got any nice, slick, simple answers. In fact, I don't believe there are any nice, slick, simple answers. But I hope together we can try and wrestle with some of the real challenges which, as technology advances, the ethical questions that it raises. My background is as a baby doctor. I worked for many years in a big intensive care unit for babies in central London, including caring for some extremely tiny and fragile little babies, premature babies, going right down to the limits of viability. So out of the normal 40 weeks of pregnancy, or 9 months, we cared for babies who were born as young as 24 weeks, 23 weeks, even 22 weeks. And the smallest baby I cared for, whoever survived, was born at 21 weeks and 6 days gestation and weighed about 500 grams and fitted literally in the palm of my hand. And we have the ability to keep babies alive has advanced dramatically over the last few years. And in fact, the majority of babies born around 24 weeks, 25 weeks, will survive in major centers. It's a very sophisticated, technologically demanding kind of medicine. I worked for many years in an intensive care unit like this. We care for some of these tiny little vulnerable beings. And clearly we invest a lot of resources in babies like this. It costs about £1,500 to £2,000 per baby per day to care for a baby like this. And the total costs of ensuring that an extremely premature baby survives can be as much as £100,000 or even more, all paid for by the NHS, all free at the time of the point of need. And we have a big team of doctors and nurses and lots of specialist equipment. So clearly we as a society are saying that these lives are precious, that they're valuable, that it's worth investing this kind of money in it. In fact, this is my hand and one of the babies on the baby unit, just to give you an idea of the scale. But as technology advances, it raises all kinds of questions. And actually, that was the reason I became interested in medical ethics. I actually started off I went into pediatrics because I loved children. And I loved, I found this kind of medicine very, very demanding and rewarding. But the more I worked in this area, the more I realized I was in the midst of a whole ethical maelstrom of all kinds of questions that were being raised. And particularly, I was involved in the question of diagnosing brain damage. This is a brain scan from a premature baby. It shows bleeding in the center of the brain. The white is blood. And we're now able to predict with quite a lot of accuracy what the likely consequences would be if we detect brain damage. But then the question comes, how do we use this information? Is it ever right to switch off the life support machinery and allow a baby to die? And how do we make those kind of decisions? How do we decide when enough is enough? And who should make those decisions? Is this a matter for doctors? Is it a matter for the law courts? Is it a matter for parents? So these are some very, very complex and difficult questions which technology raises. But just one floor away in the same hospital where I worked for many years, I've now retired from the NHS, although I'm still working as an academic in areas of medical ethics. But just one floor away from the intensive care unit for babies is the fetal medicine unit. And here, pregnant women from a wide area of London and the southeast are referred, particularly if there's an abnormality of the unborn baby, the fetus. And again, it's a very high-tech area, very sophisticated ultrasound scanning. This is amniocentesis, where fluid is taken from around the baby and is analyzed. And in particular, the chromosomes are often obtained. These are the chromosomes from an unborn baby. We know that it's a little girl because she's got two X chromosomes. If it was a boy, there would be an X and a Y. But she has an additional chromosome here. Instead of two 21 chromosomes, she has three 21 chromosomes. So this is Down syndrome. And we know that this baby is going to develop Down syndrome, but we can't predict how severe it's going to be, what the consequences might be. And what we do know, though, however, is that this baby is going to be affected in some way. This child is going to be affected in some way by Down syndrome. And in the UK, whenever this is diagnosed before birth, the mother will be offered an abortion. And the figures suggest, I don't know whether you could guess or you know, what percentage of mothers would choose to have an abortion if this particular pattern is recognized before birth. Anybody would like to guess, or 50%? Any other? 80%. Well, the answer is 90%, 91%. So more than 9 out of 10 mothers will choose to have an abortion if Down syndrome is found at present in our society. And what's just as troubling is that because the amniocentesis procedure itself carries the risk of causing a miscarriage and therefore leading to the death of a baby, there's actually, for every one baby who's diagnosed with Down syndrome, another baby may well die, a healthy baby may die, just because of the testing procedure. And another thing which is really troubling is that in the UK, most people don't know this, but actually in the UK it's legal for an abortion to be carried out at any stage of the pregnancy, all the way up till term, if it's being done for a medical reason, such as Down syndrome or some other abnormality of the baby. So in my own hospital in London, and also this happens in Birmingham and in other major centres around the country, late abortions, or they're actually called feticides, are carried out because of a fetal abnormality at 26 weeks, 28 weeks, 30 weeks, 32 weeks, and beyond. And many times in my own career, I've been called up to go from the baby unit, where we're struggling to save some incredibly tiny babies, to go one floor up to talk to a pregnant woman who's considering having an abortion. And the baby in her womb is considerably bigger and tougher and stronger than some of the babies we're struggling to save one floor down. And then you say to yourself, how is it possible in one hospital and in one NHS system for these two apparently contradictory activities to be going on? On one place, we're desperately trying to save tiny babies. In another place, we're preparing, if necessary, if the parents agree, to take the life of babies. And it just shows you that how sometimes confusing it is to work in the modern NHS, and the kind of challenges and difficulties which we face, those of us who are health professionals. And I'm saying this not in any kind of judgmental way, but just really to point out that these issues are very real, and they touch real people. In fact, I've come to the conclusion that pretty well every ethical dilemma in medicine starts as an issue of human pain. It starts from human beings who suffer and bleed and struggle and worry and agonize about what is the right thing to do. And so I think whenever we talk about these kind of ethical issues, and it's particularly true if we are Christian people, we should talk about these issues, if you like, with tears in our eyes, not with rhetoric and judgment in our voices. And I sometimes hear Christians talking about these issues in a very harsh and judgmental way. And I understand why they do this, but I think it actually causes a lot of damage. It's like twisting a knife in the hearts of so many people who are personally affected by these issues. And I don't know anything about you, but you know, we've got to remember that these are not issues just out there in society. No, actually, they're issues in here, inside this church building. I mean, I don't know anything about you, but I can guarantee that there are many people here who have been touched in some personal way by some of the issues we're talking about, such as abortion. The statistics suggest that 1 in 3 women will have an abortion in their lifetime. And for every woman who's affected, there's a man. And this is something which affects all people, not just out there in secular society, but also in the Christian church. And so many people here actually will have been personally affected, although maybe nobody knows. And one of the sad things about this is that it's like there's a great conspiracy of silence. We can never talk about the fact abortion is so common. It's one of the commonest procedures that happens in the NHS. And yet it's like there's just a great conspiracy of silence. And in fact, to be honest, often the church is regarded as the worst possible place to talk about this. If you're going to talk about this, well, go and talk to your GP or talk to a counsellor, but for goodness sake, don't talk about it in church. Because in church, there's just going to be condemnation and judgment and misunderstanding and pain. And that seems to be very sad, but it is the reality. Going back to Down syndrome, again, you know, it's not just issues at the beginning of life. We're going to talk briefly about issues at the end of life, about dying and cancer and so on. And many people, again, have been touched by this. You may have watched a close friend or relative dying and been wondering whether actually killing them would have been better to put them out of their misery. You may have had suicidal thoughts yourself. So these things are very common. And that's something which touch many of us just because of our humanity. Go back to Down syndrome. People have calculated the number of missing children there are in our society because of abortion. So this slide, if you see, it starts at 1990. It goes up into the mid-2000s. The blue line is the total number of babies who are conceived who have Down syndrome. And as you can see, it's rising steadily. And the reason for that is that maternal age is getting older. Older women are having babies, and we know that the risks of Down syndrome increase as you get older. And that's the reason why the total number of babies who are being conceived with Down syndrome. But the green line is the total number of babies born with Down syndrome. And you can see that that's actually steady. So the gap between these two lines is all the babies who've been aborted as a result of diagnosis before birth. And it's interesting to see the rhetoric, the way that the language about abortion has changed. Once, when abortion was legalized, it's just over 50 years ago, in 1967, the language that was used is that abortion should only be available in very extreme circumstances. And the argument was compassion. Compassion for mothers who were suffering because they had so many children and they were unable to care for them. But then with the rise of feminism and what used to be called women's lib in the 1970s and 80s, the arguments change. And instead of abortion available in extreme circumstances, it should be abortion on demand or as an option on request. And therefore, the argument is about liberation. Women's free to do with what they like with their bodies. Those arguments are still around now. But it's interesting is that often the arguments these days are about if you know that your child is unwanted or you can't give the very best care for your child, then you have a duty to have an abortion. It's an argument based on social responsibility. In terms of the actual figures, there are about 700,000 babies born every year in England and Wales. And these are the most recent statistics we have. So just under 200,000 abortions. So about one in four of all pregnancies will end in an abortion. As I said, it's one of the commonest procedures that happens in the US. 98% in the UK. 98% were funded by the NHS, although the majority of them now actually happen in private clinics. And you don't even need to go to your GP. You can simply ring a number, go into a private clinic and have an abortion there and then. And nobody need know. If you're young, your parents don't need to know. And the NHS will pay for it. All you need to do is give your postcode. You don't even, the family doctor doesn't need to know if you say you don't want them to. The majority of abortions happen early on in pregnancy, but then, as you can see, there are significant numbers that happen over 24 weeks. 20 weeks, and the numbers are much less over 24 weeks, as I was saying, but they do happen, and they happen in my hospital and in other major centres. Only less than 2% happen because of a risk of disability. So the vast majority of abortions are where the baby is completely healthy, but is unwanted for whatever reason. And the number which happened because of a risk to the mother's life, as you can see, is actually very unusual. And in my own medical career, I can only think of a sort of handful of cases where abortions were necessary because of the mother's life. If you look across the world, I'm afraid the situation is the same. And in fact, it's utterly startling. The estimates are 56 million abortions happening each year across the world. Just think of those just unbelievable figures, aren't they? And perhaps many people would be surprised to hear that the highest rates are actually in developing countries, not in the rich countries, even though in many of those countries it's actually abortion is completely illegal. But there's a huge amount of illegal abortions going on, sometimes called by doctors, sometimes by just other people. And globally, one in four pregnancies across the world end in abortion. So there's a massive amount going on across the world. And one of the very sad things is that it's particularly abortion is happening among women, female fetuses. And people have calculated the millions of missing women and girls because of selective abortion, even though, again, in most countries this is completely illegal, and yet it's actually happening. You think that's bad enough, but actually there's a very strong campaign going on now in the UK to strip away any kind of legal control and to so-called decriminalise abortion completely. And the arguments are that women should be completely free to choose whether or not to have an abortion. They could have it at any stage of the pregnancy. They could take abortion pills over the internet. They should be allowed to do this in their own homes, without any kind of medical supervision. And bizarrely to me, this is being supported by the Royal College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists, by the BMA, by the Royal College of GPs, even though I have to say my own perspective is that this seems almost barbaric, the idea that you know, completely unsupported, people should be able to procure abortions and in their own homes without any kind of help. At least if an abortion is being carried out in a professional setting, there are professional people around to support people. The idea that this is just being done in homes. And yet, why are all these professionals supporting this? And I think it's just because there is such fear of them professionals being seen to be, quotes, patriarchal, patronizing, that the feminist arguments are so strong. And the argument is, this is my body. The fetus inside me is simply some tissue. It's part of my body, and I should have an absolute right of whatever I do with my body. Those are the arguments that are, and there's going to be a strong push in Parliament, probably later this year, to decriminalise abortion and to take away all legal controls. Incidentally, if that's something you feel strongly about and wish to contribute to that debate, then one of the things you can do is write to your MP or send an email to your MP. Because MPs don't get many letters or emails, and when they do get them, they have to take them seriously. And if this is something that you feel strongly about, then I can suggest find out who your local MP is and contact them and say you don't think it would be right to remove legal protection completely. So why is all this happening? Well, I think the main response is what the philosophers call autonomy, autonomos, which means literally, I make my own rules. I am the boss of my own life. I choose what happens to my body. And no one else has any right to tell me about this. And many philosophers and ethicists believe that the principle of autonomy is the single most important principle. Now, everything else is secondary. The most important principle is that people have the right to do whatever they like with their bodies. That's basically the principle of autonomy. But also, many people see this as a technological fix. It's a way of solving. You think of all the complex things that go into an unplanned pregnancy. Why were the couple actually sleeping together? And what did they think they were doing? And what happened to the contraception? And was she being coerced or manipulated? Was she drunk? Was it date rape? What all these sort of things. What was going on? This is an incredibly complicated human, personal situation. And what's the solution? Oh, it's very easy. 10 minutes, suction catheter, problem solved. Where you go, all gone. It's a classic sort of technological fix. And surprise, surprise, it doesn't work. This is much more complex. It's a much more complex human issue. And the idea that a simple technological fix to the problem of unplanned pregnancy is clearly just unhelpful. But nonetheless, that is the dominant way of thinking about this. The health planners say that the statistics show that the average age of the onset of sexual intercourse is between 15 and 16. That's the median age at the first intercourse. The average age at which people want to have a baby is 30. That's the average age of the first baby, when the first baby is born, maternal age. And so therefore, there are 14 years of sexual activity between 16 and 30 when people want to have sex and they don't want to have a baby. And that's why the health planners say that's why you've got to have a liberal abortion law. There are always going to be contraception failure and mistakes and one-night stands and all the rest. And there are so many people having sex but not wanting to have babies. In fact, many modern people don't really see any connection between sex and having babies. Sex is a recreational activity. It's about having fun and about having as many orgasms as you want. Sorry, I'm talking about orgasms in church, but, you know, bear with me. I'm a doctor, you know, I'm allowed to talk about this stuff. So you're allowed to have as many orgasms as you want, as long as no one else gets hurt. And it's just about having fun. Now, having a baby, oh, that's very, very different. You've got to be very responsible. You've got to make sure you go to your doctor and take your folic acid. You've got to have all the proper tests, you know. And it's like these two activities really have no connection. My wife has worked for many years as a counsellor in London, and including crisis pregnancy counselling. And she says the number of women who've come to her and said, I just can't believe it. I'm pregnant. It never once crossed my mind that such a thing could ever possibly happen. I've been sleeping with my boyfriend for the last 3 years, but it never once crossed my mind that I could possibly get pregnant. And it's just, you think, you know, what planet are you living on? Interestingly, I would suggest from a Christian point of view, these two things belong together. Making love and making babies belong together. They're not two completely separate things. The part of the way that God made it, it's not an accident that the most profound way we have of showing love to another human being in a physical form is also the way you make a baby. That's not an accident of biology. That's the way it was meant to be. Making love and making babies belongs together. So you may think that all that stuff about Down syndrome is difficult enough. It's about to get worse, and that's because as technology advances, it's now possible to do a simple blood test in a pregnant woman and get a detailed readout of the genetics of the baby. And that's something called free fetal DNA. I haven't time to talk about it in detail at the moment. But what it means is, just in, at the moment, this is a research procedure, but just suppose in 5 years, 10 years' time, you or your daughter is pregnant, and you're delighted about this, and you're looking forward to meeting the baby, and they say, we're just going to do a simple blood test, check everything's all right. And you go back 2 weeks later, and they say, well, you're having a little girl, congratulations, but there's a 60 or 70% chance she's going to get breast or ovarian cancer before the age of 50. And there's an increased risk of type 2 diabetes. And we're also worried about early onset Alzheimer's disease. Now, do you think it would be responsible for you to bring this baby into the world? Or do you think it would be more responsible to have an abortion and have another chance at having a healthier child? So you can just imagine the sort of challenges and questions which just ordinary people who've never thought about any of this before are suddenly going to be pitchforked into making all these kinds of decisions. Just fast forward to the end of life, as we know, there's been many, many sad stories in the newspapers and in the media and on television about people who wanted to kill themselves, who felt their lives were not worth living. The guy on the right in the white shirt is Jeff Spector. He was a self-made businessman doing very well for himself. But then he was diagnosed with having an incurable tumor on his spine. And the tumor was growing and was about to press on the spinal cord. And the doctors told him that, unfortunately, he was about to become paralyzed. They would probably be able to control the tumor, but they wouldn't be able to prevent him becoming paralyzed and being in a wheelchair. And Jeff Spector said, absolutely no way, Jose. That's not me. That's not the way I want to live. And so he called his family and his friends together, and they had a celebration meal. And apparently this was the photograph at the celebration meal. And there at the meal, he announced to them that the following morning he was taking the plane to Switzerland and he was going to be killed in the suicide clinic in Switzerland. And they remonstrated with him and tried to persuade him, you can't do this and we love you. But he said, no, this is the best thing for me. And actually, I believe I'm doing it for them. I'm being altruistic. I don't want to be a burden to them. I don't want to cause problems. I don't want to cause difficulties to my family. And the newspapers, by and large, said, what a responsible man. You know, he didn't want to cause problems for his relatives. He didn't want to have to be looked after. He did the decent thing. He took his own life. And why on earth did he have to travel to Switzerland to have it? Why couldn't it be done under the NHS if he really wanted to take his life? And then there'd be many other sad stories like this. This is the story of Daniel James, a very promising young rugby player, played for the junior England team, he was then involved with a horrible rugby accident, and he fractured his cervical spine here, paralyzed from the shoulders downward, in a wheelchair, unable to move anything apart from his arms a bit. And he became deeply depressed. He was a very sporty, athletic sort of guy. His parents tried to chivvy him along. They bought him some gym equipment. They tried to encourage him. But then he said to them, if you really love me, you'll help me to kill myself. And eventually, they agreed, and they went with him to the clinic in Switzerland, and he was killed. And again, the newspaper comments were very positive. And Baroness Warnock, very eminent moral philosopher who's just recently died, came out in public and said, and defended what they were doing. And again said, why on earth do they have to go to Switzerland? If people want to kill themselves in this kind of situation, then they should have the right to do so. And so there's been a constant pressure to change the law here in the UK to allow doctors to kill patients or to help them to kill themselves. So at the moment, the law is absolutely clear that both homicide, which is intentional killing, and assisted suicide, helping someone else to kill, is completely illegal, and they are both serious criminal offences. If you help someone to commit suicide, you could end up in prison for many years, particularly if you're a professional person, such as a doctor or a carer. And I'm glad to say that at the moment, the law that governing doctors is exactly the same as the rest of society. Doctors don't have a 00 prefix, like James Bond. They're not licensed to kill. They are governed by exactly the same law as everybody else. And I have to say, I think that's quite right, too. But the aim is to change the law so that doctors would have this special license, that under special circumstances, they would be allowed to kill their patients or to assist them to die by giving them lethal poisons. The place where this kind of medical killing is going on to the greatest extent is the Netherlands, which was the first country to legalize medical killing. And as you can see, there's been an inexorable and steady rise in the number of cases going on since it was legalized in 2002. And in fact, euthanasia, medical killing for cancer, is regarded as completely routine now in the Netherlands. It's not at all anything strange. It's normally done by family doctors. They do it in their own home. Every family doctor will have a case every 1 or 2 years. And they do it by lethal injection. They just inject into a vein, and the person dies literally on the end of the needle. And the debate now is not about cancer, but it's about other conditions such as dementia or psychiatric disorders. There have already been cases of people who've been killed with conditions such as schizophrenia, severe depression, anorexia nervosa, even someone with severe transgender issues who became deeply depressed and felt their life wasn't worth living. And also with dementia. So these are cases involving patients with dementia. And many people are seeing what's going on in the Netherlands and saying this is the way to go. They are accepting that dementia under severe cases is appropriate. And Mary Warnock, in fact, said, if you've got dementia, you're wasting your own life and you're wasting other people's lives who are caring for you. And she said, I strongly believe that if people want to die because they're a burden to others, then they too should have the right to be killed. And there are many other people who think that. They rarely say it in public because they know that it's politically unacceptable at the moment. But there are lots of doctors and others who think that because dementia is increasing at such a rate, that maybe that would be the best solution. In Holland, as I say, euthanasia has now been extended to children with things like cancer. It's been extended to psychiatric patients. Now the debate is going on with elderly people who are just, quote, tired of life, and whether they too should have the right to be killed by a doctor. At the moment, the doctors are resisting this. Is no, you've got to have a disease. If you haven't got a disease, we're not going to kill you. If you're not actually, you can't be, quote, suffering from life. But there are many people arguing that actually, if I'm decided I've lived long enough and I want to end my life, then it's your responsibility, the doctors, to make sure that you do it cleanly. It's also spreading across the states. There are a whole number of states in the USA that have now legalized assisted suicide. California's one of the latest to go that way. As we all know, what happens in California often ends here a few years later. So I think there is going to be continual pressure to change the law here and to allow some forms of medical killing to happen. As I said before, a lot of the worry is particularly about dementia and the fact that the cases of dementia are increasing. And in fact, these show the estimated number of people with dementia in the UK, 2012, 800,000, 1 million, 2021, 1.7 million in 2051. And again, this is because dementia is an age-related disease, and as the population is aging, I have to say, I look around here and I can see evidence that the population is aging, just like me. There are going to be more and more people with dementia. Dementia is not the same as aging. It's actually a disease. Not everybody gets it, but the older you get, the greater chance that you're going to get dementia. And so the people say, how are we going to cope with so many people with dementia as a society? And maybe helping them to kill themselves would be the best solution. So as I said, these are desperately painful and challenging, difficult issues. I don't have any easy answers. But I think there is a wider question, and that is, what does it mean to die well? If you ask people how they want to die, I think you can predict what the commonest answer is. I want to die in my bed at night. I don't want to have any warning. I don't want to have any premonition. I just want to go to bed one night and gone. No awareness, no knowledge, no nothing, just wiped out. What a wonderful way to die. It's interesting that, in fact, most people don't die like that. More than 50% of people die in an NHS hospital. And many people, sadly, die like one of these two ways. On the left is failed cardiopulmonary resuscitation, which is a terrible way to die, with people jumping up and down in your chest, giving you electric shocks, squirting you full of drugs into your heart to try and get... Or else they die like this on the right, which is in an intensive care unit surrounded by machines and anonymous professionals. So part of the reason for giving talks like this is I really want to try and encourage people to start to have the discussion about how you would like to die and talking to your loved ones about it. At the moment, it's almost like a taboo subject. We just can't talk about it. We just can't go there. And interestingly, it seems it's for Christian people, it's just as bad as it is for people who aren't Christians. In fact, there's even evidence from the States that Christian people, or at least in the States, are more likely to end up dying in an intensive care unit and insisting on futile and unnecessary treatment compared to people who have no religious faith, which you might think is rather bizarre, and I think it is too, but nonetheless, that's what the evidence shows. So A lot of people, you know, these are very important issues. And incidentally, just if I could pause for a quick, sorry about the plug, but I've written a book called Dying Well, which is specifically trying to help people think about these issues and have the conversation intended both for people who know that they're coming to the end of their own lives, but also those people who are caring for people at the end of life. And there are copies available at the back for £5. So let me just move on now, as I'm just over halfway of my talk. I really want to now think about Christian responses. So I'm coming from the perspective of the Christian faith and say, how can we as Christians, those of us who are Christians here, how can we think about these issues and engage in them? And I like this idea that Christian ethics, the way we are called to treat one another, comes from Christian anthropology, which is the way we are made, the way that God has created us. So if we really want to think about how to respond to some of these issues, we need to go more deeply into what it means to be human. What is it about humanity? Because this will help us as we try and address some of these painful and difficult issues. And what the Bible teaches us is that Christians are not, that human beings are not self-explanatory. We are derivative, we are derived from something else. We derive our meaning from outside ourselves. And in the very first chapter in Genesis, there are these words, let us make human beings in our image, in our likeness. Now just suppose that some super intelligent beings on the Andromeda galaxy are receiving through space a very strange, distorted image. You can imagine these super intelligent beings trying to work out exactly what this image means and looking at the different arrangements, analyzing every significant pixel and so on. They will never know what they're looking at until they work out that actually this image is a map. It's the London Underground map. And those collection of lines reflect something completely different. What they reflect are these strange metallic beings which go trundling around in a particular planet, in a particular part of the Earth, of the solar system. So these two things, on the one hand, this strange lines of images and so on, and then these metallic beings, have a hidden connection. One is a map of the other. One is an image of the other. Now that's just some kind of analogy, but it seems to me what the Bible is teaching is that Almighty God chose to take a humble, pathetic, carbon-based life form and use that life form as a kind of map, as a kind of reflection of his own character, of his own being. And that means you will never understand what it means to be human unless you understand that we are maps. We reflect something outside us. We reflect the character and the being of God himself. So human beings are not self-explanatory, and the structure of our humanity, the values and the purposes of our lives only make sense because we're created in God's image. And our dignity and our significance comes from our godlikeness because we are made in God's image. But also what the Bible says in the next chapter in Genesis, chapter 2, it says that human beings are made out of dust. And actually, in Hebrew, the word for human, which is Adam, is derived from the word for ground, which is Adama. So in the literal Hebrew, we are groundlings. That's what it means to be human. And did you know the same is true in English? Human, the word human, is derived from humus. Not the nice stuff you put on pita bread, but the compost heap. That's what we are. It's in our name. We are made out of the compost heap. Humus, human. And that means that in God's design, we are actually made out of the same stuff as everything else. And that means we're designed to be fragile and dependent and frail and vulnerable. And for those of you who are Christians and know your Bibles, you will know that this comes before the fall. This is nothing to do with the fall. This is nothing to do with evil. This is design. This is the way God wanted it to be. He chose to make us fragile and dependent. And that means that we are designed to depend on one another. You came into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. And the very fact that you're sitting there and looking reasonably together tells me that when you were born, somebody loved you. Somebody cared for you. Somebody kept you warm. Somebody fed you. Somebody wiped your bottom. Because you could do absolutely nothing for yourself, and you would have died unless somebody cared for you. And then we go through this phase of our life when other people depend on us. My wife and I, we've got three grown-up boys, and we've been looking after them and caring for them for a very long time, and eventually we've got rid of them, and they've gone away, and we think, good, thank goodness for that. And then the phone rings, Dad, Dad, can you put £1,000 in my account? Dad, can I borrow the car for 3 months? You know, so this period when other people depend on us seems to go on for an awful long time. But you know, most of us are going to end our lives utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. And this was brought home to me very forcefully when my own lovely mother, who was a very vivacious and active lady, was struck down by a horrible kind of dementia. And in front of our eyes, she was transformed into somebody who could do nothing for herself. She was trapped inside her body. She was confused, hallucinating. She was unable to care for herself. She was having 24-hour nursing care. And near the end, I was visiting her, and somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon in my hand, and I was trying to feed her. Open your mouth, here it comes, open your mouth. And then I suddenly had this flashback. This was precisely what she used to do for me. And now the tables were turned, and we were caring for her. And I remember thinking very clearly as it happened, you know, this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it means to be a son, and she was learning more of what it means to be a mother. Because dependence is part of the story. It's part of the way that God has made us. So dependence is not an alien or subhuman or undignified condition. It's part of the narrative of every human life. And that's, if you know your Bibles, you know that the Apostle Paul says, bear one another's burdens, and then you will fulfill the law of Christ. I hear a lot of older people especially say something like, I just don't want to be a burden to anybody. I'm very happy to care for other people. I'll look after them. I'll care for them. I'll do whatever you like. But if I ever become a burden and I need to be looked after, then I'm going to say to the Lord, thank you very much. I've had my life. It's time to go to heaven now. Goodbye. But, you know, I believe that's wrong. And I think if you ever hear somebody say to you, I just don't want to be a burden, you must immediately say to them, you are wrong. You're designed to be a burden to me. And I'm designed to be a burden to you. And the life that God has given us is mutual burdensomeness. We bear one another's burdens. And that is a very countercultural way of thinking. In a world which prizes autonomy, it's my body, my life, I do it my way. That's not a Christian way of thinking. We bear one another's burdens. Then as we think about the life as it develops in the womb, I quite often show this picture when I'm teaching medical students. I say, imagine this is what you look like when you were born. That's exactly what you look like. And then this is what you look like at 28 weeks. And this is what you look like at 18 weeks. And this is what you look like at 6 weeks. And this is what you look like at 3 weeks. And this is what you look like at 3 days. As you go back into your own story, in your own mother's womb, is there any point at which you can say, oh no, that's not me, that's just a blob? I don't think there is. However far you go back into your own story, that was you. What the psalmist says, remember in Psalm 139, your eyes saw my unformed being, as he talks to God. You knit me together in my mother's womb. That was me in my womb. There's no point at which you can say, that's not me. But we can't expect biology to find the point at which God is involved with this being in the womb, because it's not a scientific question. It's a question of love. How do you find a person? You don't find a person with an electron microscope. You find a person through love. As we reach out to this being in the womb, then we discover that they're a person. And I had a nice example of this on the internet. This is a very early ultrasound, and this little blob here is 5 millimeters in length. So if you think what 5 millimeters is, this tiny, tiny little blob. But what love sees is, we're having a baby. So it's love which sees the person and which sees that this person has to be protected and cared for. Now, that's the story, amazing so far. The Christian then story goes on and is even more bizarre, because the God of the universe, the God of total power and authority, he turns himself into one of these pathetic carbon-based life forms. And he can do nothing. He's born as a baby, and he can do nothing for himself. He is utterly and totally dependent. And he needs to be fed, and he needs to have his bottom wiped, and he needs to be kept warm. And at the end of the life, of his life on earth, the God of total power and authority, according to the Christian message and gospel, that God, in the person of Jesus, is stretched out on a cross, and through parched lips he says, I am thirsty. And he can do nothing for himself. He's utterly and totally dependent. So God chooses voluntarily to enter into the experience of dependence. And yet his status and his dignity is in no way touched by his dependence. And that we need to remember that. So if you find yourself, as you may well do, and as I may well do, in a hospital bed, and we need to be washed, and we need to be fed, and we need to have our bottom wiped, and we are totally dependent, our unique dignity and status will in no way be touched by our dependence, because God himself has been there before. God in the person of Jesus has experienced every phase of what it means to be human. And as somebody put it, he was with us in the darkness of the womb, as he will be with us in the darkness of the tomb. So our humanity is not a barrier which gets in the way between us and God. The strange, wonderful message of the Christian gospel is that actually our humanity is the very means by which God is revealed in weakness and in dependence. And there's this amazing story in Luke's gospel, which is basically of two pregnant women having a natter. I don't know about you, but if I was writing a gospel to prove that Jesus was God, I wouldn't put in two pregnant women having a natter. But Luke, the physician, said that story is just so amazing, I've got to put it in my gospel. And you probably remember the story. Mary has just received the message from the angel that she's going to be pregnant. And Mary takes a deep breath and she says, I agree. Let it be to me as you have said. I am the bond slave of the Lord. And then she goes running to meet her cousin Elizabeth, who's also pregnant. And as she comes running into the room, calling Elizabeth's name, Elizabeth is filled with the Holy Spirit and she says, Blessed are you, Mary, and blessed is the fruit of your womb. And why am I so favored that the mother of my Lord should come to me? As soon as the sound of your greeting reached my ears, the baby in my womb leapt for joy. And in fact, from the outside, there are just two pregnant women. But actually, what Luke is saying is there are four people in that room. There's Mary and there's Elizabeth, there's the unborn Jesus, and there's the unborn John the Baptist. And John the Baptist is leaping for joy at the presence of Jesus in the same way that the lame man is going to leap for joy 30 years later when Jesus passes by. And actually, you can sort of roughly work out where they are. This is John the Baptist. He's about 7 months, and he's leaping for joy, as you can see. And where is Jesus? Who Elizabeth called the mother of my Lord. And the answer is, this is about here. Jesus is no more than 3 weeks. He's a tiny, tiny little speck. And yet Elizabeth, filled by the Holy Spirit, says, my Lord. Isn't that amazing and strange? And you couldn't invent that story. It's so bizarre and ridiculous that the God of the universe is a tiny little speck in a human womb. But it makes me think about this diagram, because many times as I've looked at this picture, I've said, where is God in that picture and where am I? Is it like I'm this little hand desperately hanging on and God is the great big hand holding and supporting me? Well, yes, that's how it feels. But you know, amazingly, you can spin the picture around and the God of the universe of total power chooses to turn himself into the little hand. And he makes himself vulnerable and fragile. So I'm coming to the end. How do we respond to this? I want to say we need to defend the preciousness of every human life because this is the form in which God became flesh. Every human life matters, however damaged, however disabled, however affected by dementia, because every human being is reflecting God in some kind of way. We need to remember that dependence and fragility and vulnerability, these are part of the creation design. This is the way God made us. But what about the problems of abortion and euthanasia? Well, whenever we say that something is wrong, we must immediately say, and here is a better way. And I think there is a better way, and that is caring for babies who are unwanted or who have severe abnormalities. This is a little baby called baby Christopher, who I knew very well. I knew his parents well. They went to the same church as we go in central London. This was their first pregnancy, and they were really overjoyed and wanting to meet their baby. And then it turned to tragedy because the baby had a severe genetic abnormality called Edwards syndrome. And Edwards syndrome is universally fatal. And there was a lot of pressure from the doctors to have an abortion because why put yourself through it? Why put the baby through it? But Alan and Verity, the parents, said, how can we destroy the baby that God has given us? And so little baby Christopher was born. And to everyone's surprise, he didn't die straight away. And they cared for him and took him home. And they used to bring him along to church where he became like a mini celebrity. He was a very small baby. He was only about 5 pounds. And everybody wanted to cuddle him. He was passed from arm to arm. Everybody knew about baby Christopher. Everybody wanted to meet him and to cuddle him. And in fact, he lived for 7 months. And touched many lives. And then eventually he got weaker and weaker and he died at home in his parents' arms. And there was a memorial service in the church and over 400 people turned up to pay tribute to this tiny, pathetic little baby. When he died, he was still 5 pounds, the same size as when he was born. And one of Alan's Verity's friends said, you know, although Christopher couldn't grow, he helped other people to grow. And so I think showing that actually even the most disabled and malformed and lives which many people would think are worthless, actually those lives can be profoundly significant and touch many others. And I love these words from a philosopher called Joseph Pieper. Love is a way of saying to a person, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. The trouble with abortion and euthanasia is it says it's bad that you exist. It'd be much better for the world if you didn't exist. But it seems to me genuine love always says, it's good that you exist. It's good that you're in the world. And the way we can do this practically is support people who have unplanned pregnancies and help them to see that they don't have to have an abortion. There are other options. And my wife has been involved for many years with a crisis pregnancy center in central London on the Caledonian Road. They advertise on the internet and they provide non-judgmental, free counseling and support for parents and for mothers and sometimes their partners who are considering having an abortion. They help them look at all the options they have, including continuing the pregnancy. They have a shop front there, just an anonymous shop front where they provide counseling. They also provide support for people who've had abortions and who are confused and hurting and provide specific abortion recovery program. They provide relationships and sexual health education in schools. And for people who are continuing the pregnancy, especially single unsupported women, they provide a befriending service where they will help vulnerable pregnant women and mums of young children. They have a baby boutique where they have free clothing and baby equipment, which has been donated from churches in the area. And they provide it free and loan out equipment for single pregnant women and for those of mothers with young children. They have a community support group. And so here is a sort of practical response. It's not about campaigning. They're not involved in the political process. They're simply showing practical support and care and saying, there is a better way. You don't have to have an abortion. We can help you and support you and show you a better way together. And over the years, many women have been able to find the courage to be able to continue the pregnancy. Wouldn't it be wonderful if there was a centre like this here? Sadly, there isn't. The nearest centre like this is in Manchester, or many miles away. But if this is an issue which you feel moved by and you're thinking, what would be a practical Christian response? Well, then something like this would be a practical way forward. Can I also say that if there's somebody here who's been affected by abortion in the past and you'd really like to talk to someone, can I really ask you to actually have the courage to go and seek help? There is skilled professional and specialist help available, both for men and women who've been affected by abortion in the past. So please seek help for it. And just thinking about, what about people at the end of life? Well, I think the answer is palliative care. And I haven't time to go into detail about palliative care, but would you be happy if there were questions about it? But this wonderful lady, Cicely Saunders, invented a whole new way of caring for dying people. And one of the things she said is, you don't have to kill the patient in order to kill the pain. And palliative care has been is a wonderful, and again, she was a Christian, and it was really, the whole development of palliative care was a Christian response to the problem of pain and suffering at the end of life. She realized that the problem was much more than physical pain. There were many other kinds of pain, and so that palliative care provides a holistic care for every aspect of the person. And I'll finish with this quote. Suffering is not a question which demands an answer. It's not a problem which demands a solution. It's a mystery which demands a presence. We are called, if we are Christian believers, to be the presence with people who are suffering. And in my own experience as a doctor, there's no higher privilege than to try to be the presence, to be there with people who are suffering, even if we can't solve the problem, even if we can't make it go away. So I'll close there. If there are particular questions that you'd like to raise, please write it down. We'll have a quick break, and then there'll be an opportunity to try and respond to some questions. Thanks very much. So lots of very good questions, and I'm going to be in difficulty to address them all. So a number of questions about abortion, particularly what are often called the hard cases. So the hard cases don't deal with, as I said, 98% of abortions are so-called social reasons. The hard cases are where there is severe fetal abnormality, the sort that I've already talked about, where the mother's life is at risk, or where the pregnancy is conceived through rape. And so the questions are, what do I feel about these hard cases? There are several questions basically raising that. My own belief, and certainly my wife, who's had decades of experience of counselling women in this situation, she would feel that even in these very painful issues to do with fetal abnormality and to do with rape, that actually the better solution is to continue the pregnancy and support the mother and the baby. What she says is that she feels that so often the way it's presented are the interests of the baby and the interests of the mother are in conflict. It's presented as a sort of battle, who wins, the mother or the baby. And that's a completely false and misleading way of thinking about it. In reality, in nearly all circumstances, the interests of the mother and the interests of the baby are aligned. They are together. What's good for the mother is good for the baby. What's good for the baby is good for the mother. And therefore, helping both mother and baby to survive is actually usually the best solution, even in these very painful cases. And I and my wife have both been involved in cases where women have become pregnant through rape and have seen in this terrible, catastrophic situation where the woman has been deeply violated, what we both believe is that to do an abortion in the naive belief that just solves it is completely wrong. In fact, what my wife would say is that it's like adding a second violation to this first violation. And all the evidence is that women who have tragically become pregnant through rape and then have had abortions often have very severe long-term issues and guilt and shame and all kinds of complicated social issues. Whereas those who found the ability to continue the pregnancy, and I can think of several examples, yes, they often have a terrible struggles and difficulties sometimes as single unsupported parents, but actually they're very proud of what they've achieved and they're very proud of their child because however that baby was conceived, it's still their baby. So it's not an easy solution. I'm not by any way saying it is easy, and I would never judge anybody who had an abortion because they felt there was no alternative. But actually, I genuinely believe there is a positive alternative. If you're interested, particularly in the issue of rape, there's an amazing book called Startling Beauty, written by a woman who was herself raped by an intruder and who went through the whole issue and agonized about it and eventually continued the pregnancy. I haven't more time to talk about it, but it's an amazingly striking story if you're really interested in that topic. What about where the mother's life is at risk? Well, that, I think, again, what's really important is that in the rare situations that the mother's life is at risk, the choice is between both the mother and the baby dies, or the mother lives but the baby dies. It's not that you can choose one or the other life. Medically, that's impossible. The only choice you have medically is that both the mother and the baby die, or you do an abortion, the baby dies and the mother lives. And in those situations, I mean, I do think that that's a Christian option, in those rare, terribly painful situations, to take the life of the baby in order that the mother should live, rather than that both of them die. But I think that's a very unusual situation, and tragic situation, but it does occasionally happen. Now, one of the other questions was, how can we respond as health professionals in these situations? And would it be ever right not to care for instance, if someone was working in an NHS hospital, not to care for somebody who was having an abortion? I think the important thing is, yes, we do have the right of conscience, and this is protected in the law, but what we object to is we object to a procedure, we don't object to a patient. So we will always carry on caring for a patient. What we object to is participating in the actual procedure. So I think, yes, we do have the right to say, I don't want to, and I be involved in any way in the abortion procedure itself, but we still have a duty of care to care for patients. There's another question about how can we be involved politically in this, or how can we make our voices heard? And I do think there is a place for Christians to be involved politically in this issue, and as I said, writing to your MP is a really good way. If you're interested in knowing what's happening in Parliament, there's a Christian organization called CARE, C-A-R-E, and they are actively involved in Parliament. They produce prayer information and other regular information, so you can be participating in that, and they can help you in terms of contacting GPs and MPs and responding to them. The same is true at the end of life. There was a question about campaigning at the end of life. I would strongly suggest being involved in organizations. There's an organization called Care Not Killing. The questioner who asked about Care Not Killing implied that that's entirely an organization for disabled people. That isn't true. It's actually Christians are very, very active in Care Not Killing. But it's an alliance between Christians and other people, all of whom concerned, to try to stop the law being changed. So I would recommend you becoming a member and supporting that. There was a question about palliative care. Palliative care doesn't work in every situation. Make this the last question. Palliative care doesn't work in every situation. Why is that? And the answer is, do you remember I showed that picture of total pain? There's physical pain, psychological pain, relational pain, and spiritual pain. If palliative care doesn't work, in other words, despite receiving large amounts of pain relief and medical care, the person still seems to be very distressed and in agony, I can guarantee that that is not physical pain. But what it means is there is something else going on. There's either a relational problem, a spiritual problem, a psychological problem. And therefore, what we need to do is get to the bottom of what the problem is. The answer is not to kill you or kill the person who's in deep distress at the end of life. The answer is to find what is causing the distress. And actually, interestingly, very often it's a spiritual problem. And therefore, there is a real place for spiritual care, sensitively, thoughtfully, compassionately, at the end of life. Okay, there was another question here which was about ectopic pregnancy. Is an ectopic pregnancy classed as an abortion when it's removed? And the answer is no. An ectopic pregnancy is where a pregnancy is formed, but instead of passing as it normally does down the fallopian tube and into the womb where it's implanted, it implants somewhere else, usually in the tube, sometimes outside. And in that situation, unfortunately, there's absolutely no chance that the baby can survive, and it does threaten the life of the mother. And so once that's diagnosed, it's actually a medical emergency, and normally what would be done then is that a surgical operation is done to remove the ectopic pregnancy. Actually, that isn't regarded as an abortion. It wouldn't be recorded under the normal figures. It's a separate procedure, although, as you can see, it carries similarities. An abortion is where there's a normal pregnancy, but a procedure is done to interrupt and to destroy the embryo or the fetus as part of a normal pregnancy. So, there's a comment here. There seems to be a dichotomy between preserving life until you're old, and then when you're old, there's a desire for you to take your own life, or this emphasis on suicide. It is interesting how suicide is being rehabilitated, I think it is, as almost like a noble or honourable way to die. That's what people said about Daniel James or about Jeff Spector. They were being honourable, they were being noble, they were being altruistic. Now, it's interesting, if you go back to the pre-Christian era, particularly into the Roman and the Greek and the other ancient civilizations, pretty well all of those civilizations honored suicide as a noble way to die. It was the death of the warrior, it was the death of a hero, it was actually a noble way to die, and many of the philosophers supported it. And that's also been true in many, for instance, in Japanese culture, in Norse culture, in Hindu culture, and so on. There are many examples where various forms of suicide were celebrated and as being noble and honorable. But interestingly, in the Bible, suicide is never seen as a noble way to die. It's always seen as an act of despair and hopelessness. If you think of Judas Iscariot, who hanged himself, or you think of King Saul, who at the end of his life, in failure, asked his armor bearer to kill him. So suicide itself is always seen as an act of hopelessness and despair. But interestingly, suicidal thoughts are quite common in God's people. So Elijah says, "It's enough, Lord, take my life." But God doesn't say, "Okay, I'll take your life." Instead, he sends Elijah on a sabbatical. And because Elijah's got to learn there's more things that God wants to do with him. And Job curses the day he was born, and Jeremiah. There are lots of examples. Moses. Lots of examples of people who had suicidal thoughts. But suicide itself is never seen as a noble way to die. And it's the same is true in all cultures influenced by Christianity. That's why throughout the last 2,000 years, ever since Christianity influenced Western civilization, we've always seen suicide as something to try and prevent. And we go to enormous lengths to try and prevent people committing suicide, something all doctors are trained in how to prevent suicide in their patients. Happens in prisons, happens in institutions, every people on suicide watch to try and prevent suicide. But isn't it interesting that as the Christian influence in our society is now declining, many people talking about we're in a post-Christian world, lo and behold, suicide is being re-engineered as a noble way to die. And that's really why this move to the law, it, it, it's a pre-Christian, it's a pagan way of death, but it's now coming back as being seen as a noble, as an altruistic way to die. IVF and leftover embryos. Gosh, this is another. This is a problem to do with in vitro fertilization when large number of embryos are created in a test tube, and then either two or three are put back into the womb, but then you sometimes may be left with 6, 8, 10, 12, even 20 spare embryos, and then the question is, what do you do with them? And you can either donate them to somebody else, to another woman who can become pregnant through them. You can use them for research, in which case they will be destroyed in the process of research. You can put them in the freezer, and it turns out you can keep embryos going for decades and then thaw them out and use them again. I personally feel that the best solution to having spare embryos is not to create them in the first place. And it is perfectly possible not to create all those extra embryos. You simply create the embryos that you're going to use directly in the cycle. In other words, you just create two or three embryos. Now, that has a lower chances of success compared to creating all these extra spare ones, but my belief is actually it's a better option, because I've had people come to me and say, you know, we had IVF, we've got two children, that's fine, but now we're thinking we've got these eight embryos in the freezer, and what do we do? And, you know, I actually think, well, perhaps you should have thought of that before you created the embryos. I didn't say that. But I think we need to, that we don't need to create spare embryos. What you can do is you can freeze eggs. And freezing eggs doesn't have the same kind of ethical problems, in my view, as freezing embryos. And therefore, I think egg freezing is a better option. Particularly under certain circumstances where, for instance, women may be having chemotherapy, or which is going to affect their chances of having babies. Freezing eggs may have a role there. So another question about palliative care, and what happens when, even though the doctor has given a lot of drugs, the patient still seems to be in pain. Is it ever right to overcome the pain to give an overdose of painkillers? So I don't actually think that is right. Certainly deliberately to kill through painkillers is never right. But what should be done is try to work out what is the form of pain. Because surprise, surprise, morphine isn't very good for relational pain or spiritual pain. It doesn't work very well. And so, for instance, as many people are facing the end of their life, it's often these deep personal agonies which are surfacing, and therefore helping people to address those issues. And that's why it's so important to be talking about these issues before we face the end of our lives. That's why it's really important to try and have the conversations in advance, if we possibly can. There's a question about a pregnant teenager. If a teenager was giving birth, is there a higher chance of dying than if they were an adult? Well, the truth is, the chance of dying is absolutely minuscule, thankfully, in the West. The chance of dying is something like 1 in 100,000, even for a teenager, with the right kind of medical care. So it isn't a reason for having an abortion, even in the case of teenage pregnancy. Sadly, abortions are very often done, and then it leads to often difficulties, including psychological difficulties. So again, abortion seems to be a quick fix. It solves the problem and so on. But again, why is the teenager pregnant? What are the issues going on? What are the complex social, psychological, relational things going on? How can we help and support them rather than just think that killing the baby is going to solve the problem? Realistically, what can we hope for is the best in terms of changes in the law going forwards? Well, realistically, I have to say the chances that we're going to be able to change the law significantly in either abortion or euthanasia against these is actually very, very small. But the truth is, it's not primarily an issue of the law. As I said before, abortion is very common across the world, even in places where it's completely illegal. This tells you that the issue is not about the law. And so our goal is not to make abortion illegal, it's to make abortion unthinkable. In other words, it's changing attitudes. That's really what we should be aiming for. And that isn't impossible. In fact, in history, there have been many times when social attitudes have changed completely. Just take slavery. If you go back into the 18th and early 19th century, it was completely normal and accepted that slavery should go on. In fact, it was supported by many people, including, I have to say, by many Christian people, as completely normal. Now, 200 years later, after William Wilberforce and all the great people who worked in slavery and so on, attitudes to slavery have completely changed. Sadly, we know it's still going on, but nobody thinks seriously that slavery is the right thing to do, that it's slavery is even thinkable. To take another human being and make them subject to your own will and control their lives, that's just wrong. So it shows you that attitudes can change over time. And by God's grace, it's possible that in 50 or 100 years' time, people would say, why on earth would you kill your baby? I mean, that's just unthinkable, wrong. We just don't do it. We support people, we help them, but we don't kill babies. So I think it would be possible to change attitudes. But the question is, if you're a Christian, then you know that we're called to be salt and light. We're called to stand up in the place where we are for the value of life and not just talk about it but actually demonstrate it. So if we are genuinely wanting to help in this area, then the question is, how are we supporting single mothers? How are we helping people with unplanned pregnancy? How are we demonstrating that life is precious and that we think life is good? It's much more than just talk. It's actually demonstrating it with our actions. Okay, I think that's about it. I've done pretty well with all the questions. So thank you so much. I'm very happy to hang on if you'd like to ask some more.